Good afternoon, everybody. It's Kevin Stevenson. Thanks for joining me today on I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. I'm in a new home studio. Check it out behind me. It's going to evolve as we go, and there's certainly more to talk about regarding that, but we're not going to go into that today. I want to go straight into today's guest. Join me in welcoming Brett Brummett. Brett is the founder of Generous Benefits. Brett, welcome to I Don't Care.
Perfect to be here.
Let's get going into a little bit of about what Generous Benefits does. Talk a little bit about yourself and about the company and why you started it.
Yeah, so I came from a traditional insurance background of there's a product to sell, there's a problem to solve, there's a need to fill. And really about 10 years or so years ago, I started having I feel like I'm only catching a really small portion of the problems that a workforce and an employer faces. And I started going on this journey to find more and more what about this idea? What about this iteration of a product? Where are things trending? And so the idea really birthed out of the idea of a generous orthodoxy, a book by one of my friends, we may need a broader idea of what is good and correct for faith. And I just applied that to benefits and said, we may need a much broader idea of what, a benefit is. And so we've seen that not only from just things I've gone looking, but even in the last 10 years, the things that have evolved and emerged and really started to take root now in some of the, it's probably still fringe conversations, but those fringe conversations are becoming more and more commonplace around benefits these days.
Yeah. With employers having to compete globally now and competing for talent that a lot of them desire, remote work. And so, you've got to really enrich those benefits, even though many industries are still having some difficulties, even though, we're a few years out of COVID, but they're still having those financial difficulties. So talk a little bit about some of the benefits that you've seen evolve over these last 10 years that employers have found that their employees are interested in, or employers have gotten very creative in coming up with different ideas.
Yeah. And both of those things have happened, and, more solutions now exist because employers were creative and somebody wanted to scale and make a dime on that too. So, originally, if we go back 10 years, there was the beginning parts of more virtual medical care. I was a real early adopter using a online specialist back in the early 2000s, 2002, 2003. I was sending a picture of a rash over for a doctor to check out. But again, early adopter to where, more people are real familiar with a telemedicine visit of some form, virtual medicine, more dedicated virtual physicians. And so those benefits have been emerging in any kind of, the traditional telemedicine to a virtual direct primary care, virtual physical therapy, a lot, just because the access is so limited on the mental health side. We see a lot move in the virtual mental health space. So counselors, psychologists, psychiatrists, all three in those benefits that have lower dollar per month access points because they're not really built around an insurance product. They're built around that service model and delivery. And those have really taken off a ton in the past 6 years, accelerated from the COVID eras, things that were, toyed with became commonplace. And then all of a sudden everyone realized they didn't want to go to a doctor's office and wait. They'd rather wait at home on their couch. In the North Texas area, 15 years ago, we had a white glove, called white glove, where they brought the nurse practitioner or the mid-level provider out to your house. And that seemed to be awesome. And it went away. And now we've seen a couple of other, urgent care to go, dispatch health, come back in again, more often on the monthly subscription fee for an employer or even an individual on those services. So they don't pay anything at the time of service. And, much like Netflix, everything's moved into that membership model, that monthly fee, what can we get on a recurring monthly fee? And that's been the same for benefits, and we've seen employers adopt those. And that's been, you know, whether it's any part of that scale, even down to the telepet, texting the veterinarian.
Beautiful.
You know, you know, there was a teledentistry, which, you know, probably is fine if you just want to figure out if you got to go to the emergency room for a cyst or an abscess, but who knows how that one played out. I never got to test that one out before it came in and out.
Yeah, I think I'd have to stay away from that one. But
yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, I actually utilized some of the virtual physical therapy stuff this year because I wanted to know what the experience was like. And that's one of the things that we do at our firm. We experiment on ourselves. You know, what you're not supposed to do as a scientist, you can do in benefits. So, I was like, all right, so I know that my left leg is a little weaker than my right leg. And so how do I use a physical therapy virtual, you know, and they attach the things to you and sit in front of the camera and you do the exercises and you get a report.
Yeah.
And then they're like, easy, harder? What is it? So it's interesting versus going in.
Yeah. You've touched on a lot of actually some past podcasts that I've had. A couple of years back, I talked to a telemental health group, telepsychiatry group, and it was very fascinating because, you know, as you know, certainly, you know, Central Texas and really all across the country has a real void in mental health providers. And so people are looking for ways to be able to get that level of care. And telehealth has really helped bridge that gap. And you know, I started my career on the physical medicine and rehab side, so I was very familiar with, you know, PT, OT, speech, and all of that, and never really thought about telephysical therapy until I had a guest from a company out of Israel that was doing tele-PT. And it makes sense, you know, once you get that initial evaluation. Basically, I mean, I hate to say this because I love my PT friends, you know, you can do your exercises at home if you have the appropriate motivation. But if you have the tele-PT aspect, you've at least got somebody encouraging and making sure that you're doing your exercises appropriately. And then, you know, as you were talking about, I remember White Glove in North Texas, and the accessibility to primary care has, you know, plummeted over the last 10 to 15 years. And so I think people are just looking at ways to extend all facets of healthcare, and people are becoming so much more accepting of the telehealth model that honestly, you know, 25 years ago when I was at a hospital in outstate Nebraska with very few specialists, that's how we cared for our primary and secondary service areas, was through telemedicine, which at that time was very new to the game. So,
yeah. And it's the adoption iterations of it. And then, like, honestly, like, we shouldn't have had to had a worldwide issue for it to become commonality, commonized. And even, you know, what we're sitting here mid-2025 and legislation just passed to bring back the ability to have telemedicine as a viable service recently. Like, that's okay. At least it's codified in legislative code so it can be done, you know, and billable again, you know, because it's hard to do medicine if you can't make money on it. And so the convenience factor for the patient and the accessibility is now restored or front and center of what was there, taken away, put back in again. And now we get to move forward. And these things are going to keep building into new models. It'll be interesting to see where they go. And I think we will have that pendulum swing too. You know, we're seeing that, as I mentioned, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act legislation of recent, you know, putting direct primary care back into a way to be used as a, you know, product inside a health savings account. You know, does that probably change that much for a lot of people? No, but does it bring it back to where we're going to see that pendulum swing from more virtual medicine, and then people are going to want to have more of a personal, time sensitive touch in person? I mean, we always see pendulum swing, and so we'll see that. But, you know, most all of those doctors, for the most part, really love to do a good hybrid combination of in person and virtual. you know, and they're paid essentially for customer service, because you don't pay that membership fee if you don't feel like you're getting good service. And I do think you're seeing, and that's one of the other trends that, you know, we've seen over the past 7-8 years starting to take a foothold. I think you will actually see that rolled out now more than ever because of that act, even though it didn't change much from a functionality. But the fact that insurance feels like it can play with it now in an HSA setting, I do think you'll see more mainline vendors do the things that we've done with virtual and direct primary care, building them into health plans as a, either as like an upgrade for member experience, or a, how do you carve out and have a better primary care investment from a company so that you don't have so much, you know, upstream higher cost care, which is what we do for our clients a lot of times.
Very good. Well, we've talked about a lot of the traditional benefits, and you kind of touched on some of the more interesting benefits that people requesting in the televet space. What are some of the more unique benefits that employers and employees have come to you about and said, hey, can we make this happen?
Yeah. You know, a lot, and this has been driven by the employers, and it's not so much, can we make this happen? It's been, can we clean up the mess we've created? So a lot of employers have been doing some version of cash for this, cash for that, an allowance for here that we've got to go prove up and reimburse through, you know, checks or payroll. And so we've seen a big growth in, you know, what's been around for a while, like fringe benefits, like lifestyle spending accounts, cash accounts for things that are non-traditional. And so a lot of things have moved from like we pay for a gym membership to we'll reimburse you, or you can have the debit card for the gym membership, the cash account for gym memberships. I've got one of our clients, and this actually was a COVID thing. He's like, I want to start paying for DoorDash deliveries. Huh. Like, our people are hurting. Like, can we just give them a stipend for DoorDash? And I said, okay, well, yes. Yeah. Can we do it? Can we do more in DoorDash? Can we do HelloFresh too? Can we give a meal prep? So maybe it's a little healthier food, maybe, quote unquote, you know, that's useful. Dollar goes a little further. And so meal deliveries, like, you know, $50 a month stipends for those going on a lifestyle spending account. And we're starting to see other employers look, you know, things that lived in those perks programs kind of areas, like, you know, the old school from the 80s, the discount on your AT&T cell phone, you know, now back to discounts at local vendors around you because it's in your company, tied with that dollar amount you can spend either locally or on the other things. It's really the cash account and the cash based accounts. I've never seen more adaptation in those than I have in the past 3 years. And that's actually brought people along more in the old traditional cash accounts like FSAs and dependent care, and everyone's dollar is going less far. So everyone's looking for a way, like, where can I get a pre-tax edge? And then employers again are looking like, what are the things that make us unique to stand out? And so if it is, you know, a cash account for, you know, a wellness benefit like a massage, or again, back to mental health therapy, adult sports leagues, those are the things we've seen taken off quite a lot in that area. And it's been really interesting to see, because those are fun ways you talk about a company's workforce and their unique needs. And you just don't overcomplicate the model with a product as much as you do a delivery mechanism. So really, it's been cleaning up the administration of the things that the employers have started doing as one-offs and making them more replicable.
Okay. Yeah, that makes perfectly good sense. I remember I was with a hospital years ago, and one of our benefits, and it was new and unique, was the fact that we had chiropractic coverage, but we also had massage therapy and a lot of other holistic therapies available to us in a traditional hospital setting. And so I'm not going to lie, my wife and I took advantage of $10 massages a couple of times a week. And so, you know, it was a great benefit.
Mm-hmm. Those are great benefits. You know, as we're talking, I'm thinking of the other one that has been asked about more and more. And I feel like this is a lot of people ask and very few execute on it, but that's been back in the fertility treatment, egg freezing, you know, banking of items in that area. That, and that's really been driven a lot, I feel, from that was a traditional benefit of, you know, the Facebook Metas, the high tech firms. And, you know, a couple of years ago with the mass layoffs, those workers have been moving and looking for jobs that have some of those similar benefits, and more employers competing for that talent are trying to figure out a way to, one, how do we have that as a benefit? But two, if we do so, how do we not kill our medical plan for high cost births or treatments that we're now covering? Same to be said of the GLP-1s. Like, how are we going to give this thing that everyone wants and manage the cost of it? Like, are we going to start including things for weight loss that we were only including for diabetes? You know, that's been for the last 2 years, one of the biggest, largest changes everyone's been grappling with.
Yeah. Okay. Another area that I know has been growing, I'm just curious to what extent it is that the elder care respite care benefit. You know, how prevalent is that now? Because I know, you know, that's something that people of my age and obviously 10, 15 years younger are really interested in with aging parents.
Yeah, that's probably the flip side of the crazier trends. You know, we're going back a decade, and a lot of these, about 10 years ago, you know, and prior to that, those were traditional employer-based benefits, like a long-term care policy, a nursing care policy, an at-home care policy. Those were all insurance products that very much lived either because you talked to your financial planner or it was something delivered through your workplace.
Yeah.
And they had cataclysmic losses on the insurance plans about a decade ago. And you started seeing insurance carriers, you know, a Unum or a MetLife or one of the others, like sunsetting those programs, Transamerica, they stopped selling those programs out there because of the losses they were taking on them. And nothing's ever really, from an insurance product that I know of, fully reemerged to the scale we had. The products are coming back. Those are a huge conversation point.
Okay.
But it's those have lived back in some kind of financial planning, annuity rollover, life insurance funding, accelerated death benefit to use in the older age. And I haven't seen a lot of growth in it in the employer space, at least in the sub 5,000 employee life space employers, because I don't typically get in the over 5,000 lives. Yeah. So I may have a blind spot on that marketplace.
Interesting. Okay. Well, hey, let's talk a little bit about, you know, I shouldn't even have to say this, but the cost of benefits continue to rise. And the burden continues to rise for both employers and employees. So what are you seeing as far as cost containment strategies that, you know, are producing that desired, you know, reining in of the financial impact while trying to minimize the consumer experience impact?
Yeah. And this is probably one of the things that I spend the most time on, just because that's what I'm paid to spend my most time on. Like, how do I reduce the company cost? How do we reduce the spend? And then in the same breath, and not have our employees revolt either from a cost or a quality or access. So how are we going to lower costs and not have, you know, employee revolt on our hands? And that really becomes the matter of how do you find what's beneficial? Like, how do you share in the wins as an employer? So as an employer, if we can find a way to save on, you know, knee replacements, how does the employee win? Like, are we able to pay less for the knee replacement? Can we waive a cost for the employee? Those are the kind of things that have been going on. And those come with like bundled surgical contracts as a cost containment. And those are predictable to most degree. Like, you're going to have so many people need back surgery, so many people need knee replacements based on your population, based on your industry. And so there are ways to go around and find somebody willing to do that for a price that's under your traditional, you know, insurance reimbursement model. Mm-hmm. And so being able to carve that out and having a set price has been something that's been going on for, you know, several years now. We're seeing that actually develop and advance more outside of just those bundled services or prepaid services, or even just creating a direct contract for a service line. We're now seeing more and more employers and brokers and TPAs create direct contracts outside of an insurance contract. And what happens is you end up with a tiered network approach. So you And you probably remember these again back from the 80s.
Sure. We
have like a three-tier approach. Like tier one is your lowest cost network for care. Tier two is your regular, and tier three is out of network. And I'm so sorry for you. You know, play stupid game, pay stupid prizes. That's out of network. That's happening again. So we're seeing a lot of tier one network development with a narrow network of, you know, you've got three hospitals in town or two hospitals in town. If you go hospital A, we're not going to charge you your deductible. You go to hospital B, yeah, it's going to be run under your, you know, traditional insurance network contract, and you're going to have your $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000 deductible and your percentage. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing financial incentives given to the employee because the employer and or whoever's designed the plan, whether that's TPA consultant, has gone out and created a contract that is going to pay that service in most cases less than the regular insurance. And again, insurance, PPO networks, HMO networks, you know, we're battling the idea that those things have been around now for 40 years. They've outlived and morphed beyond their original intent. And so, you know, the idea that every apple has a shelf life, we've had to recreate bypasses to get past the rotten apple in pricing. So those direct contracts often are paying, you know, 200 or 150 or 160% of Medicare rates, whereas the PPO contracts are paying 260 to 400. So, I mean, if you're saving that large of a delta on costs, why not share a tiny bit of that with the employee? Because you're talking about $80,000 services. What's a $5,000 deductible when you're saving 80? And these make great cost containment. Same things happen in drugs. And we're seeing a lot more of that again, now that there's a huge spotlight on PBMs, the rebate game. We've seen a huge shift away from like carving out some of the modification plans as the manufacturer assistance, pharmacy assistance programs are shrinking. Those are coming back, but we're also starting to slowly, thanks to outside forces like Mark Cuban's deal, like legislative forces, bring back the rebate game on those so that you're actually finally having a member pay closer to true acquisition costs. And those are trending emerging areas to watch. And those have been really super financially incentivized as you've seen more things come back from that. But at the same time, we're seeing those high dollar specialty drugs, especially in the cancer area. You know, those are the super high dollar ones that have driven so fast, so far and rampant. And then, you know, your lower level specialty, like the GLP-1s, the ones that are in the $1,000 a month range, you know, now we're seeing those with rebates back at the $400 a month alongside a direct to consumer market by those same that are back at that 400 fighting the compounding pharmacy, you know, quote unquote, knockoff versions of the same drugs. And that access to care, the understanding of how to get those has brought everything back into that cost containment conversation. And the consumer is really just willing to do things differently today than they were 3 years ago with inflation. Like, whereas I'm not going to give up what my insurance, or I'm not going to give up this drug, or I'm not going to give up this pharmacy. Those have emerged. I mean, for us, you know, we actually moved over to a concierge pharmacy arrangement where we're bypassing the PBM completely on all of our low-cost drugs. And that saved us a ton of money. And oddly, our pharmacy, our pharmacist, and the clinical people we talk to, they're nice. They like to talk to us. It's not like going to the pharmacy over at the big box where you stand in line and they can't repeat what you said or answer a question. So we're seeing the consumer, and again, guinea pig testing on us. We go through it first, go through this, and what can we do? Does this make a financial savings? Is it a cost containment? And can we do a cost containment that doesn't create employee distrust? Because any strategy that an employer or a health plan rolls out, once the employee distrusts it or thinks something is not in their best interest, like that's wildfire that goes corruption wide and every good intent goes out the window. And you've got like two more years of trying to undo a little bit of bad, you know, bad press amongst your employees.
Yeah.
Like I can't see my doctor anymore. I can't take my kid to the doctor. I can't take my kid to Cook Children's. Like these are problems that you really like need to address up front in a cost containment so that your strategy doesn't die when it comes to time of service.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I know whenever we were in the Dallas-Fort Worth marketplace, every year right before contract, or every 3 years before contracting, the billboards would come up all over town from, various health systems saying, make sure that you contact your insurance company to ensure that Brand X Health System is still available. And, being in the industry, I had a number of phone calls from friends. Oh my gosh, what's going to happen if I can't go to XYZ hospital? I said, trust me, they'll get the contract done, but this is part of the negotiation process. But yeah.
And that's super frustrating to the consumer, especially, every 3 years when the hospital contract comes up. And those tactics have gotten, the billboards don't work anymore. So now it's the letters at home and the publications and the press release in the paper. And we're seeing them actually now drop out of contract for 30, 60, 45 days and put patients in limbo. And for the first time, I really feel like about 3 years ago, one down in the Houston area when they actually called the bluff and they just dropped out of network and they've never come back. That nice nonprofit health system down there for the one carrier. Like it put people in a pickle. But again, I think you're also coming to a consumer that's going to eventually decide, I realize I can't go to all three hospitals in my area. Now, the consumer with one hospital in the area is really in a pinch. But the multi-provider areas, I think you will see a big alignment on health plan to hospital. If not, like we're doing with the direct contracts, point A for your service is free, point B is going to cost you your deductible. I do think we'll see a lot more trend to, point A only.
Yeah.
We're gonna give up being able to see everybody and only being able to see the ones that can come to agreements as a price point, because that will shift.
Oh, I agree. I totally agree. Well, hey, Brett, we're coming up against time. Any last words that you'd like to share with my audience?
Yeah, there's a way to get to where you want. And as long as you define where you want to get to, a good consultant, a good broker, they can work alongside you. You may have to adjust where you want to get to because some things might be unreasonable. We can't get back to the $100 employee, $400 family rates,
Right.
but we can sure get to where you want to go within the right parameters today. And innovation is there, cost containment is there. And as long as you're willing to have robust conversations early enough in the game, then the destination is not a problem. And
Great.
that's probably what I would share.
Very good. Okay, Brett, if anybody's interested in talking to you about helping them out, how do they contact you?
Yeah, easiest is good old-fashioned email. It's Brett with one T or two T's if you want to misspell it. They both go to me. So just Brett with one T at generousbenefits.com. And that's really the easiest way.
Very good, very good. Well, I appreciate it. Brett, thanks so much for being on I Don't Care today, and make sure that you tell your wife, Amanda, I said hello. And so I won't make that mistake again. That was kind of embarrassing. But anyway, again, Brett, thanks
Made
for joining
for
me.
fun.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it today. Well, that's another episode of I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. Thanks so much for joining me today, and we'll see you again very soon. Take care.